Joining us now on the phone is Alan J. Carlson, who spent his career as a diplomat for the U.S. government and who was recently in Grand Marais to facilitate the Cook County Great Decisions Discussion Group discussing nuclear arms negotiations. He's here to discuss Foreign Service Day, share his insights from his career as a diplomat attending to nuclear arms negotiations, and also his enthusiasm for the Great Decisions Discussion Program. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back on the air with you.
Oh, and I'm so glad that you could make the time for us, especially, you know, it's Friday, it's in the evening, you'd probably rather just be kicking back, so thank you. So, it's Foreign Service Day.
Yes. Most people have not heard of Foreign Service Day, I'm sure. The U.S. Senate back in 1966, by a bipartisan resolution, Democrats and Republicans alike, agreed that a day should be set aside every year to honor the U.S. American diplomats, especially those that had given their lives in heroic or stressful circumstances for the U.S. And American people.
And so that's celebrated on
the first Friday of every May.
Okay, and what kinds of commemorations are occurring today?
The big one will be at the U.S. State Department itself. Just inside the main lobby of the U.S. State Department, which people have probably seen on TV, you have not seen, there are plaques to either side with the names of 250 American diplomats who lost their lives in tragic circumstances in service.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, the very first diplomat ever sent out by the United States never arrived. He was lost at sea someplace between here and Europe.
Ouch.
As I said, it goes all the way up to very recent times. Very fortunately this year, we did not add any names. We added two names last year. And during my time in service, one of my friends that I entered the service with, we enter in classes of about 40, was killed during Osama bin Laden's attacks in East Africa in 98.
Wow, and I'm guessing that with such a small class that you all really are very close.
We are.
Even after leaving official service.
We kind of figure there's the old Kevin Bacon 6 degrees of separation meme. In the State Department, it's about two.
I like that. Oh, so Alan, I'm really curious. I'm just a curious person about how people find themselves in different careers or places
right.
in life. And so can you talk to us a little bit about your career and how did it even happen that you became a diplomat?
I was always interested in diplomacy when I was a kid and going through college, and I took courses in diplomatic history, but back then, I had no idea how you became a Foreign Service officer. When I was in law school, I went to the law school here at the university. One of my professors had also served as the counselor on international law for the State Department. And so I was talking to him, and I was thinking about that as I was finishing up my law degree. And I practiced for a little bit of time, but I also decided I wanted to do something more interesting than law. And being a diplomat is certainly one of the most interesting things you can do.
Sure. And you had a mentor who was encouraging you, which is perhaps what often gets people into interesting things.
And so I took the exam. At that time, there were two exams, a written exam, which is very much like the SATs, and an oral exam, which I figured out about 10 years after I passed it, was really measuring whether the person they were talking to was poised under pressure.
Ah.
And it tests some other things as well, but that's pretty much the core of what distinguishes people who pass from those who don't. And got in and spent 25 years going to half a dozen countries and working in Washington, D.C. as well.
Wow. And just out of curiosity, is there a specific educational profile that's preferred for these positions, or is it?
There is not. In fact, I've seen a correct four requirements to become a Foreign Service officer. You must be a U.S. citizen. You have to be at least 21 when you enter. You can't be more than 60. And you have to be able to get a security clearance and a medical clearance.
Got it.
But as far as the educational background, really, we're the State Department looks for people with a very broad range of knowledge about a lot of issues.
Fascinating. Not just to me, but I hope some of our listeners as well who are trying to sort out what they want to do with their lives. Or...
Absolutely. And it's a very interesting and challenging career. The test itself is free, and you can find it at careers.state.gov. You can find where to sign up and what you need to do.
Okay. So you spent 24 years. Can you give us a little timeline of how you spent your time?
Well, probably the easiest way is just kind of run through the... We're assigned for 2 to 3 years on tours, just like the military, tours of duty. And the easiest way to give you a flavor is to show where I was. Our first tour was in Copenhagen, Denmark. And after that, I worked in Washington. I worked on UN affairs during the first Gulf War and during the breakup of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. And then I was in the South Asia Bureau, India and Pakistan, and that's where I really got introduced to the nuts and bolts of nuclear disarmament, nuclear weapons, missiles, and the like.
Uh-huh.
Then kind of a change of pace. I was in Jamaica for 3 years.
That's quite a change in pace.
And then training is an important part of a State Department career, so I attended the United States Command and Staff College in Quantico with 200 Marines for a year.
Wow.
That's a very different change of pace.
A very different culture.
A very different culture. And then I was assigned to Sarajevo. So that was 1999 when I arrived there, so just after the war. And I was working there for 3 years. Came back, did some more UN peacekeeping and sanctions work. Went back to the former Yugoslavia, to Montenegro for 3 years. And then from there, I went to Geneva, where the UN has what's called the Conference on Disarmament, where we're trying to write these treaties for disarmament, and where I also participated in the negotiations to write the new START treaty between Russia and the United States.
Wow, so specifically nuclear disarmament you were involved with.
And then I finished in Washington, again looking at the Balkans.
Okay. And I'm really curious, you know, I wasn't able to go to the Great Decisions Discussion Group that you so kindly joined here in Cook County, but I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners a little bit about some of the kind of major issues regarding nuclear arms negotiations, both in the past as well as now. I mean, my understanding is, like, we had a huge reduction in the number of nuclear warheads, but conditions have kind of changed since then?
Conditions have changed, and you're right, there was a huge reduction. Approximately 85% of all the nuclear weapons that the United States and Russia ever built have now been either dismantled or at least taken off of delivery systems. So they're from highs which were in around 60,000 to 80,000 each, both sides now have maybe 7,000 total. There's all sorts of little numbers here and there. But it's a great reduction. And again, a lot of this was facilitated by the end of the Cold War, and because the two major powers were always discussing nuclear issues, starting way back in the Kennedy administration. And there's a lot to be said simply for the process of discussion that's included in the negotiations to help build trust between the two sides.
Sure, having any relationship is a good start, isn't it?
Yep, and then build the trust among all people, among all the countries. Currently, there are difficulties. Some of the arms control treaties that had been reached in the past, the United States has left. We left a treaty that banned anti-ballistic missiles in 2002. President Trump decided to not certify Iran under the current Iran deal that would stop Iran's production of nuclear weapons. Both Russia and the United States have said that they're going to leave another treaty reached by Reagan and Gorbachev that eliminated missiles and nuclear weapons from the continent of Europe, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So there's a lot of stepping back. But now, positively, President Trump has also said he would like to see discussions on arms control between the United States, Russia, and China. And if they can push in that direction, that would be a good thing. China historically has been resistant to talking because they point out that the U.S. and Russia both have about 10 times as many weapons as they do.
Got it. But just the same.
The
geopolitical shifts are significant, and maybe it's time for China to join in.
it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
At least to start the discussions, I think. But for that, a framework will have to be established. Quite frankly, this administration does not have a very positive view of arms control negotiations. John Bolton, in particular, who is the National Security Advisor, feels that many treaties unfairly restrain the United States. And so he's very, 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 very cautious on arms control treaties.
Okay. So that's kind of our local political dynamics then as well that are more specific to the U.S.
Yes.
I'm wondering, too, are any changes in the technology of the missiles or the nuclear warheads or delivery systems themselves playing a big role in these changes?
Well, there's always proposals for new delivery systems. Russian President Putin, for example, last year, about a year ago, said that Russia was working on a couple of delivery systems that would either go under any missile defense system or around a missile defense system or simply race through a missile defense system. Whether any of those systems actually exist, whether they're actually practical, is another matter. It would be a good subject for discussion. The United States has said we should discuss that. Russia has said, well, we can, but maybe over in this forum, in this area, not in this area. But again, it would be a good area for discussion. But again, that's how technology makes things worse. Now, where things improve, for example, on technology, there is a comprehensive test ban treaty that was completed back in 1999 that would ban all nuclear weapons tests. It's not enforced, but there's an organization that already exists that measures and monitors all seismic events and other events that happen anywhere on the planet to determine if somebody has set off a nuke.
Got it. So at least we know if it's happening.
So we know. And that system, the technology there has gotten better pretty much with every passing year, certainly with every passing decade. So whereas back in the 60s, there was uncertainty whether you could test a nuke in secret if you were in the middle of Siberia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We're now pretty sure you couldn't do that. The system is so sensitive, for example, I was just reading again that there was a NFL football playoff game in Seattle a couple years back. And the crowd got so excited that they set up vibrations, which this organization detected.
If only we could settle for only those types of vibrations.
Correct.
What a wonderful world it would be.
So obviously, you know, if they have a lot of vibration in the football stadium outside of Seattle, they kind of go, okay, we don't think that anybody set off a nuke. But that's how sensitive it is.
And how about efforts to include, though, somehow, sort of the newer powers that have been outside of previous discussions, you know, like...
Well, Well, a lot of them actually are available for the discussions. As I said, I served in Geneva at the Conference on Disarmament for 3 years. And while not every UN member is a member in that organization, it does include all of the countries with nuclear weapons or whom we think have nuclear weapons. And that's 9 countries. The 5 big powers, India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea. Iran is also a member.
Okay.
And so there is an opportunity in that forum for discussions on nuclear weapons and, in fact, any other type of weapon, military weapon that you might want to discuss.
All right. So their voices can be included, and hopefully that can lead to engagement if all parties are willing.
And certainly, there are always continually small group and bilateral discussions as well that no one will ever, it will never be reported by any newspaper, but the discussions go on.
Wow. How are you doing with all this knowledge and awareness of all the processes going on now that you are no longer in direct service to the country?
Well, one thing I do is I've joined the Great Decisions Discussion Group here in Minneapolis. And when nuclear negotiations came up as a topic for this year, I went to our organizer, who is also the organizer of the Cook County Great Decisions Group, and said, I'd love to share my experiences and background.
Uh-huh.
And I find that very useful to, as a way to kind of keep engaged on these issues. And I write my congressmen and my senators.
Uh-huh. Good. And tell us a little bit more about the Great Decisions Discussion Group.
Right. The Great Decisions Discussions, well, this is a program of the United States Foreign Policy Association, which was established way back in 1918, 100 years ago, as World War I was coming to an end, to help Americans engage and understand the world that the United States already had all of a sudden become a much bigger part of. And one of the programs they now have is the Great Decisions, where every year they look at about 8 important issues facing the United States on the world stage and contract with experts to write an article on it. And then groups all across the country, especially in Minnesota, get together about once a month to hear from another expert and to discuss the issues.
Okay. And this is just a group of people of interest who simply want to have these discussions together. As I understand it, if people want to find out more anywhere in Minnesota, they can go to globalminnesota.org to find
Absolutely.
Out where their local groups are and what topics are coming up. Locally, there's a group here in Cook County that you came and joined. It's held from noon to 1:30 on the third Thursday of the month
right.
at the Cook County Community Center. And again, it's free. The discussion manuals are at the Grand Marais Library, a couple copies, so people can go there and read them, although you can also buy the discussion manuals. And it's essentially a national program with these discussion manuals, right?
Right, precisely.
Nice. So there are people across the nation who are having these conversations. And you were kind enough to come up and join the Cook County group recently.
Yes, I was up in April in between the storms.
that was very fortunate, a narrow window.
A narrow window there. I see the storms, again, to discuss nuclear disarmament in greater depth with pictures since it wasn't on the radio.
love it. I wish I could have been there, but unfortunately I had travel plans already. So, for our listeners who are interested, we're going to see about getting these regularly scheduled meetings announced on WTIP, but of more immediate information, if people want contact information, they can call Randy at 218-475-0091 or email him at czeswik@AOL.com. Any chance we're going to have you coming up here to Cook County again?
It may happen. My wife had come up with me on this trip, and we both decided it had been way too long since our last trip to the North Shore.
Yeah. Yeah, at least you got good waterfall season. But
absolutely, it was absolutely beautiful. And depending on the topics, I could see myself coming back up and assisting with the great decisions in Grand Marais again. Randy has booked his speakers fully for this year, so it wouldn't be until next year, but it is a possibility.
Right, and actually for our listeners, I'll mention the upcoming meeting is on May 16th, so it's a couple weeks away, and the topic will be decoding U.S.-China trade, and we'll try to get things posted for the future discussions as well on our website. We have been speaking with Alan J. Carlson, who spent his career in the Foreign Service for the U.S. government, discussing his experience in Foreign Service, especially the experience with nuclear arms negotiations and his involvement with the Cook County Great Decisions Discussion Group. Alan, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us today?
Not really. Just a very useful talk, and I hope that we can do that again sometime.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really fascinating to hear more about something that I'm not personally familiar with. So thank you so much for making the time to share your insights and your experience with us tonight.
Pleasure.